and welcome to today's episode of Just Cause. I'm your host, Rhianne Scott. I'm so pleased to share with you that my guest today is Chief of Police Stephen Tanner of the Halton Region Police Service. And January is a special month for him because it represents his 40th year of policing, and he's also celebrating 20 years as a Chief of Police. That makes him the longest serving police chief in Canada with three different police services. So a big congratulations, Steve, and I'm so pleased to be able to have you on the podcast. A bit more about him. His hometown is Oakville, Ontario, and he earned a Bachelor of Arts degree at the University of Guelph before entering the policing profession as a member of the Halton Regional Police Service in the fall of 1982. As a member of the service, Steve worked in a variety of areas, including uniform patrol, criminal investigations, tactical rescue, training, intelligence, and major crime, homicide, as well as forensic polygraph examination. He also served as an elected representative and as the chair of the Halton Regional Police Association. During his tenure, he was actively involved at the provincial level with the Police Association of Ontario. In 1998, Steve accepted the position of Deputy Chief of Operations with the Guelph Police Service, a position he held until relocating to Belleville as the Deputy Chief in 2000. In 2001, Steve graduated from the Master of Public Administration degree program at the University of Western Ontario. In 2002, he was chosen as Belleville's Chief of Police. At that time, and at the age of 41, Steve was one of the youngest, if not the youngest, chief of police in Canada. In November 2008, Steve then became the chief of the Kingston Police Force. In June 2012, Steve was named the chief of the Halton Regional Police Service and returned home to Oakville, commencing his duties with Halton in September 2012. Steve has been actively involved over many years with a variety of organizations and boards and a variety of sports teams and organizations. He has served as the president of the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police. He is currently serving his second term as the chair of the governing body of the Criminal Intelligence Service of Ontario and is a member of both the OACP and CACP organized crime committees. And he is also a long-serving member of the National Police Service's National Advisory Committee. He's a founding board member of the recently formed Abraham Global Peace Initiative, which is a group fighting for human rights on the global front. In January 2012, he was appointed by the Governor General of Canada as an officer of the Order of the Merit of the Police Services. Joining me today is Chief Steve Tanner. And Steve, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I'm so excited to have this conversation. And I have to say, as I was coming into headquarters this morning, I think the first time I was ever here was when I was pretty young in elementary school, and I went to the safety village. And I don't know if that's something that's still here, but I have fond memories, and it's been wonderful to be able to work with your team over the past several years, actually. And it's great to be here today. And I just I reflect on that as I sit in your office, Steve, with this beautiful, beautiful but misty view.
Well, that's great. And hopefully you've been a better driver and walker ever since that experience at the safety village. It is still here. It's been closed for COVID, but I think it opened in 1990, just before we moved into our old new headquarters, just across the parking lot here. So it is right there. And we moved into the intelligence office there in 1991. So that doesn't mean you went there that long ago. You probably went there 10 or 15 years ago, but it's it is a great facility. Almost every youth in Halton goes through there at one point or another.
That's fantastic.
So Steve, I'm curious about, especially, you know, since you're the chief, around what your journey to getting to this position was like, and, you know, thinking back to, you know, when you first wanted to become a police officer, what inspired you to do that?
You know, I think we all, Rhianne, get to do what we do in life, or do what profession or job we do. Sometimes it's by chance. Sometimes people plan it their whole life. So I didn't really plan to be a police officer. I went to university to become a veterinarian originally. Really? I joke that I've now probably worked with animals in one way or another for 40 years. And then I was finishing that and thinking about law school and medical school and different things. And I applied to the police department at the same time and was hired here in 1982. I could have gone to Peel or the OPP. I applied to all three, and Halton ended up being the quickest in the end. So I started here in 1982. So it's not always, I had a couple of older cousins. They were more like uncles to me than cousins, but they were both Toronto and then Peel officers. And so I had a little bit of an idea what it was like, but not something that I had planned my whole life for.
That is absolutely fascinating. I can't believe veterinary school was on your radar to do. So no, I think with Oakville being my hometown, I think we're very privileged to have received you as a police officer and now as our chief. So thinking back over your career at Halton, what types of areas and teams and departments have you worked in? What did that career progression look like for you?
You know, it's funny sometimes because there are times when you might not remember what house you lived in a certain year, but I can go from 1982 probably through every position that I had in policing, and somehow I remember that, right? So it was, you know, I think it was about 5 years in, 4.5 or 5 years into my career, I went into the detective office in Burlington. So that sort of gave you exposure to break and enter investigations and some robberies, and then onto the sexual assault team. At the same time, I had an opportunity to be on what was then a part-time tactical team, or SWAT team, as people think they are in the U.S. sort of movies. Yeah. So that sort of went from 87 until 1990. I went into, from the CIB office, into criminal intelligence and drugs, and got to run some projects and work with some other police services on what we thought were high-end drug sorts of things and organized crime back then. Mm-hmm. A large drug seizure back then was a 1 kilogram of coke. Now our projects are 25 or 50 kilograms, and fentanyl on methamphetamine. So the world's really changed around that. 1993, I had just been promoted to sergeant, and someone thought I should have some experience in the training girls. So I went there for a year, and then back as a patrol sergeant in Burlington for a year, back into the detective office as a sergeant, now running a sexual assault persons team, missing persons. And in 1996, I became the polygraph examiner within the homicide office here. So that was an interesting almost 3 years of doing lie detector tests for people that don't know what polygraphs are, but really in-depth interview, training, interrogation in some cases. But at that time, we were also providing polygraph services to Hamilton Police, which was sometimes more of my workload than Halton, with some of the cases that Hamilton were dealing with during those years. And then in 1998, I had an opportunity to go to Guelph as a deputy chief. And so it was sort of directly from operations into administration at a really senior level. So it was 1998 that I went there. Mm-hmm. A year and a half later, I was in Belleville and became the chief. I was in Belleville for 8 years and then 4 years in Kingston as the chief. And I've been back here. This is just starting my 10th year as the chief back here in Halton. So it's kind of a roundabout way of experiencing all the really interesting things in policing from a frontline perspective, other than forensic ident and canine and bomb disposal and some things that I did not do. You can't do everything, but that's one of the interesting things about policing now, is it's so varied and you really can tailor your career, you know, work hard and get along with people and do the right thing. And it's sky's the limit for anybody in this profession.
I think that's so true. And I think especially today, where people want to experience different things, that you have that ability to tailor it. So, wow, that is so interesting. You had so many different roles. And I'm curious around, you know, on the polygraph side of things, because, you know, now there is lots of debate around how accurate it is. Can people cheat them? Is there, you know, is it something that can be relied upon? Do you have any views on that? Was that a discussion back then? Or is it just now that, you know, more studies have been done on it that discussion is being had?
No, I think, going through the training at the Canadian Police College, it was 16 weeks at the time. But I still believe now it is one of the most accurate tools that we have. DNA is obviously wonderful, and fingerprints to some degree. But polygraphs are probably 98% accurate, 99%. There are some false positives and negatives. And I think most of those, when they occur, are polygraph examiner error in marking the charts. I often say to people, if you think about it, anybody can be nervous in a polygraph room or interview situation, but what makes them even more nervous is if they are guilty of something, those particular questions about the crime. So you can be very nervous or very calm, but your response to those particular crime questions are going to be immense compared to the others. And often people ask about the sociopath sort of person. Well, they don't really care about anything, so they might be able to trick a polygraph. And really, it's not true, because if you think about a sociopath and some of the worst criminals that we've dealt with in years gone by here, they might not care about what they've done to anyone else, but they care more than anybody about themselves. So if they stand something to lose or win in the polygraph, they react, I would say, as good or better than any normal person. So I've always said to people, if you're accused of doing something serious and had absolutely nothing to do with it, do the polygraph. If you had anything remotely to do with it, or, you know, somehow partially involved or something, you might not want to, but really it is an extremely accurate thing. I think our justice system is nervous of it. Sometimes I think the justice system may be nervous of it because it's actually more accurate in a way than the justice system is, because the justice system has to balance so many different pieces of evidence and conflicting witnesses and things, but it is extremely accurate. So it was a fascinating time, almost 3 years of doing that.
Do you have any memories sticking out during that point? Any interesting reactions or revelations that you can recall?
Yeah, you know, there were a couple of very serious sexual assault cases where the person was deceptive in the interview and ended up confessing to what they had done. And I've always said, equally, I think, interesting or positive or impactful, was there was an individual that was brought back to this area from a long way away because they were the main suspect in a very infamous homicide in the Hamilton area. And they came back and they agreed to do the test and did the test. And I walked in at the end of it and said, you know, so-and-so, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind you had nothing to do with this. And he was a very, you know, a rounder from the streets, a bit of a hardened criminal that had moved away. And he broke down crying, saying, this is the first time anyone's ever believed me. And they went on to arrest and, I believe, convict someone else. But their attentions, he had been the main suspect for many, many years. So it's just as much about proving someone innocent. Mm-hmm. By and large, in a police polygraph situation, you will get many more innocent people coming in than guilty people. Guilty people may find a different reason not to come in. So proportionately, you're going to prove more people innocent than not, but it's equally as powerful both ways.
That is really interesting to know. And especially, I mean, I can only imagine how much that meant to that person, and it really changed the trajectory of not just the case, but of that person's life, hopefully. Thinking also back to some of your roles, aside from the work that you were doing on the polygraph, do you have a favorite role that you've had during policing? I'm curious what that is and why.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I've actually enjoyed all of them, because intelligence was fun, and you were digging into information to help to build serious cases, and homicide was, and sexual assaults are rewarding in a different way, because you're sort of the representative, or you're representing the victim, even if they're gone and can't speak, you're finding the person responsible. The tactical rescue unit was probably one of the most enjoyable times. I think it was more the teamwork, camaraderie, teamwork, how you work together as a team and dependent on each other, which you do in all units. But it's sort of a special bond when you're going into maybe a very serious situation for a high risk arrest, and you know you have people there that are equally highly trained, all of the equipment that you need to better carry out that mission at the time is probably one of the favorite, although chief is probably my favorite for different reasons. You can make some different decisions and you don't pass the buck, but you're also not able to pass the buck. So it's I think the tactical team would be one of the highlights for sure.
Looking at your time as chief so far, and I can't believe it's been 10 years back in Halton as chief, because I remember when you were announced as coming back. So I don't know where the last decade has gone, but I guess what have been the best or the highest points, and what have been some of the most, most challenging points for you?
I think the highest points, often they revolve around the success of others, whether it's a team, or an investigation. Going way, way back, my involvement was on the periphery of the Bernardo investigations. And of course, Leslie Mahaffey was taken from Burlington, and Kristen French was left here in our area by Bernardo and Carla Homolka. But as chief, you have those high profile investigations where your team solves them, and you know that you've got the right people doing those jobs. And sometimes I often refer to homicide and sexual assault. If I know that I have the right people working in those units, then I can sleep better at night knowing that if it was, one of our kids or one of our members' kids or a relatives or a friend's children that were injured, we've got the right people there to do those investigations. So there's some of the high points are from some of the worst situations. One of them that comes to mind is the Shafia homicides in Kingston. So not long after I went to Kingston in the fall of 2008, in the spring of 2009, the four bodies of the three Shafia girls and one lady were found in a submerged vehicle at the Kingston Mills locks just north of Kingston. And a fabulous investigation where we reached out to the RCMP, who flew in interpreters from across the country so they could speak the language, which people were pretending that was the only language they could speak. And Montreal, when it came to mobile support and intelligence support in the city of Montreal, and that all came together in an amazing investigation and prosecution and conviction of the father, mother, and other son in those murders, and the technology behind the scenes of proving who might have been where and when by the use of technology was one of the highlights on the investigative side. I think, if you look in the bigger picture, it's when you are able to, either through a budget process or the attainment of some really important piece of equipment that may protect someone's life, that you have sort of those victories along the way. One of them that comes to mind sometimes here is the armored rescue vehicle. Often people will say, why does Halton need an armored rescue vehicle? Many years ago, people that I knew that were on the tactical team had to walk behind a car to try to rescue a person who had been shot on the front yard of a house and put themselves at risk. Ultimately, it took longer. The individual still succumbed to their wounds. And there's no reason that the officers and the public shouldn't have the best and the highest levels of protection. So those sorts of things are, $400,000 investments, but one incident and they're paid for. So, and I think on the, on the low side of things, sometimes you have certainly officers who are injured more often in motor vehicle accidents. But about 4 years ago now, we had two of our officers shot and wounded in a gas station situation, and ended up being a police-involved shooting as well, not too far from this headquarters building. So, those times where you're called and you're rushing to a hospital because someone is, their life is at risk or they're seriously injured, and you're hoping for the best, and meeting with family, and also the victims of some of those crimes too that you come across over the years or you know about now, and you might not meet them as chief all the time, but Sometimes there's letters of thanks for what the officers have done. And those are key times as well. Mm-hmm. Special investigations units can be very stressful for our officers. So you'll often see me on Twitter or somewhere saying that these investigations need to be done in a more timely fashion. And we need to get those results, not just for the officers, but for the victim's family and for the public. So they're not left questioning, why is this taking so long? Mm-hmm. The answer should be out as soon as it's known, it should be out. So I'll continue to push for that. But that can just be a low point because of how long it takes. And it's a source of frustration for our frontline staff.
Just on the last point as well, you know, when officers or members are injured or killed tragically, how do you manage some of the well-being and mental health aspects, whether for yourself or for your members? You know, I think one of the really positive things in policing is of the last couple of years in particular, there's been much more open dialogue about supporting mental health and actually talking about it and bringing it out of the shadows and trying to remove the stigma. And I'm curious around your thoughts around how you've dealt with that throughout your career and how you now help to support that and enable that kind of support for your members.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a multifaceted thing. I think I was just talking with another group a couple of days ago on mental health and what we do here. And we can never say who is going to be impacted or how by any incident. So it used to be very much, and you hear it in the news all the time, you know, suck it up and get back in the car and get back to work. And right after a shooting or right after a serious life-threatening potentially sort of situation. We had that here in Halton many, many years ago, pursuit of armed robbery suspects coming out of Guelph that were firing at the officers, and the platoon were put right back on the road probably within an hour after. So that's very different now. I think some of us, for whatever reason, are able to compartmentalize things differently. I've always thought of it when maybe I'm at one of the worst situations you can imagine or incidents. You're there as a police officer, so you're there to do what you are there to do. And you're not necessarily, you don't usually know the people involved. There have been times where I have known the victims of extremely violent incidents, which makes it a little bit different on the personal level. But I think some of us can detach somehow, and we don't know how. Necessarily. So we all have different coping mechanisms. Some mm-hmm. people, you know, get out with friends. Some people go home and confide in family or in a psychologist or a professional now. So we've kind of taken the guessing game out of that. And when we have serious situations now, we will by practice reach out to the people involved in those serious mm-hmm. situations. So if it's a fatal motor vehicle accident or a child's been killed or mm-hmm. Certainly tragic suicides that we deal with far too often and drug overdoses, then we have a full-time organizational wellness unit here, which is probably one of the things I'm most proud of here in Halton and in policing. And we get a lot of inquiries about how do we do it and why do we do it and what's it cost. But that full-time unit is extremely busy and reaches out to all of our members that are involved in serious situations. They also work hand in hand with our training bureau. So if we have someone involved in mm-hmm. a police related shooting and they're off for a period of time, when they come back, there's a very detailed return to work process, even up to and including ever firing a firearm again, mm-hmm. because that may be a hard point for someone to get past. So I think one of the ways that I probably deal with stress now is in the back of my mind, knowing that we're doing everything we can to make it better. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have the organizational wellness unit and we weren't reaching out to people, then I would probably not sleep as well at night and wonder, what could happen that we're not trying to prevent or mm-hmm. Or help proactively. So if you put as much as you can into the proactive side, especially of mental health for our members and for their families, and there's robust EAP programs and things. But I think it's more the organizational investment in wellness, which really probably shows through more from the org wellness unit and the work that they're doing. And they are you know, people say, can it be used too much? And I guess the answer is no, because mm-hmm. if people need it, then we want you to use it. So we've gone to an offsite facility probably 2 or 3 years ago. I've never been there intentionally because I don't want anyone to think that they could ever be there and the chief might come, right? So it used to be come right into human resources across the office or across the hall from my old office. And that wasn't comfortable for some people. So I think we have to continue to try to make those inroads and make it more normal not to be okay. But it's also not, I mean, even PTSD is not a fatal sentence. It's something that you can overcome with the right consulting and counselors. So we're working towards all that.
I think the organizational wellness team that you have is such a credit to Halton. And I definitely know people are interested in it and looking at, which is fantastic, because if you can set the example for others, I mean, you're really just expanding your impact across country or, you know, even further abroad. Speaking of stressful things, because one of the things you have to do as chief is deal with the media, deal with different types of politicians who might be curious about different things. Over the past 18 months, there's been a lot of really high profile things around Black Lives Matter and defunding the police and, you know, various aspects like that. And I'm curious around how you manage that as a person and as chief. How do you balance all the needs of the community, whether in Halton or otherwise, and your members? I'm curious around some of the ways you do that balancing act and make decisions around some of those high profile matters that are a discussion in policing almost worldwide, to be honest.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the multi-million dollar questions, right? And I think I'd start by saying nothing happens in a positive way without positive relationships. So we've invested a lot here. I mean, first of all, we're very fortunate in Halton comparatively with some other jurisdictions from a, you know, sort of socioeconomic status of most of our citizens. And there's not a lot of unemployment and poverty here, but there is, but not compared to some of our neighbors. So I think one of the things that we've invested in and had the ability to invest in for many years is relationships in our community. We've had a Chiefs Diversity Forum for many, many years. It's still very active. We've just set up a meeting for November, hopefully the last one ever, virtual. But it's a cross-section of religious and diverse leaders from across Halton who come together with us and have a very positive relationship with us. So if you build that before things happen, it becomes less of an issue after things happen or when. And so when the George Floyd murder happened in the United States, of course, there was lots of, Black Lives Matter, which I support. They've got some great instances and concerns that need to be brought forward. And we need to do a better job, not just in policing, but everywhere. Healthcare, school systems, when it comes to discrimination and issues of racism. So we're just a part of that. We had Black Lives Matter marches here, and we walked along with, largely they were younger individuals, high school or college university students, but not all. They were very peaceful. They were very law abiding, and we assisted them whenever we could. It was interesting. We even had at least one of our Black officers from Burlington wanted to walk with them. And we said, absolutely. But we think that you should walk behind them, not in front of them, because you're not leading them. You're just supporting them. So, I mean, those are subtle differences. But we didn't really have a local push on defund the police coming out of that, or coming out of some of the mental health related incidents that we've had in the GTA over the past year or so with involving police. And, you know, we did have, I think there was used to be in the old days, a letter writing campaign. Now it's an email or social media campaigns where people were reaching out to our local politicians saying you should cut the police budget by 10% or 20%. And a lot of those were not coming from Halton addresses. And when we looked at some of them and had conversations with some of our local politicians and our four mayors or our regional chair, we said, you know, like, they are the same letter. We get the way that these campaigns happen, and there's good reason for them. Nothing against them. People are trying to make points that they're very solidly behind. But at the end of the day, there was no real local push for defund the police. Now, I say that with our being the lowest price per capita police service of all of the Big 12 and many, many more in Ontario and across Canada, and the lowest crime rates and crime severity index in any large municipality across mm-hmm. Canada. So we've sort of got there and we stay there for all the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But we don't, I think as long as for myself personally, knowing that the defund the police movements are out there, there's reasons for that. Mm-hmm. And in some jurisdictions, there have probably been incidents that have spurred those movements on more than in other jurisdictions, mm-hmm. if I could say it that way. And we've been very fortunate here, but we have a lot of support here provincially and throughout our diverse groups. We launched a specially deckled and marked frontline police vehicle for Black History Month. It was done for and funded through our Canadian Caribbean Association of Halton and a couple of other Caribbean and African associations here locally who were supportive of that happening. And in some jurisdictions, people were saying that sort of public statement of support of Black History Month was not welcomed because they didn't think the relationship was there yet. Sometimes you see that with some of our ongoing issues with our Indigenous populations and a lot of the wrongs that have been done over many, many years. But sometimes our Indigenous partners will say it's not time to be at that point yet. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll get there, but we need more work, right? So I think that's how we deal with it here locally. And on a political level, we've got great support from our councillors and mayors, and they're all individuals, and there's elections coming up at just about every level in Canada mm-hmm. over the next year, and one we just recently had. So those things change all the time.
It's very true. And I think, you know, the investment in building relationships, it's actually you're working with a community and not to a community. You're not doing something to them without their support and consent. So I think the long-term support investment in building community relations has been critical. But Steve, you're very active on social media and Twitter in particular, and I'm wondering how you find that as a tool to engage with others, peers in the policing community, as well as with the public overall. How do you find that as a tool?
Well, you know, it's first of all, it's very time consuming sometimes. I mean, I think we can get distracted by social media and check Twitter to see what's on there a few times a day or whatever we do. So I think it's a conscious decision we have to make on what we're going to use it for. I mean, some people just retweet things that they think are police friendly or medicine friendly or whatever your business is. And other times there are things that are going on or an incident somewhere in Ontario or in the country that there's different statements made about that incident. And I don't think you can let it go without saying something to sort of either put the record straight or maybe at least balance it. Mm-hmm. So that's the position I find myself in once in a while. Sometimes that's involved, as an example, the Special Investigations Unit on the delayed response or closure of files. We couldn't, in policing, we could not let some files go on as long as what they have historically with the SIU. Mm-hmm. They are getting better, and the new director, I think, is working in the right directions. You also get a lot of positive feedback from frontline officers here or anywhere across Canada and from association leaders saying thank you for saying something, because the majority of people can be complacent in Canada and just not say anything. So it's, I had a police association background as well. Mm-hmm. I was the chair of the Halton Police Association, and I was on the Police Association of Ontario for a while back in the 1980s into the early 90s, I guess. So you don't forget your roots, and our police association leaders, by and large, are here to make this a better environment for their members and the safest it can be, and they're police officers and dedicated civilians too, who want to sometimes return and do police work again. So we don't always have to be at odds. Most things we can settle ahead of time and mediate things and make reasonable decisions on both sides. And once in a while, that's mm-hmm. not the case. But I think social media has a place where you need to say some things. And so we'll continue to do that. And there's just too many platforms for me to learn now. I don't think I'll ever be on TikTok, but never say never. So
never say never.
Yeah, that's
true.
Right.
That is true. I'll be seeing you doing the latest choreography at some point. That's I'm right. sure at the front of headquarters, we will have to get you to do that at some time.
So Halton is one of the safest places to live and work in the country, which is just a fantastic achievement. And I'm sure that's very reassuring to, you know, people who live and work in this region and community. And I am curious, though, because I know that we've had conversations around, you know, some of the more serious issues that your members have to deal with. What do you think Halton residents or visitors would be most surprised about, you know, to learn around, you know, what are some of the biggest issues happening in their region that they may not necessarily know about?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was giving some thought to that earlier on, and it's probably, you know, everyone complains about traffic. Nobody wants their house broken into. They want their kids to be safe when they go to school. And we work on all of those things. I think most people, unless they're in tune with some investigative journalism, you know, 60 Minutes, CBC, the sorts of things, they don't really, or they're willfully blind to things like organized crime and street gangs and human trafficking and fentanyl, methamphetamine and opioids, and the fact that people are, they're going to sell whatever they can sell to make money, and they don't care that hundreds of people are dying. I think we had 130 overdoses in a month at one point. So, you know what, we're in the GTA corridor, and what used to be thought of as Toronto street gangs are doing their business as any business would do. They've expanded and they move and they're mobile and they're selling drugs and they're running human trafficking businesses at the peril of most often very young ladies who get trapped and can't get out. So we have a full-time human trafficking unit who work specifically on that issue and have rescued a number of young girls from that human trafficking prostitution end of things. And the fentanyl, I mean, people may hear about overdoses or are warning every once in a while when it looks like there's some bad drugs around because overdoses are up. But that's, someone said to me once from CBSA, actually, no cocaine is growing here in Ontario. So it's brought here. It's from Mexico or Colombia, and usually, and it's brought here by organized crime, and it's sold by organized crime. And whether that's traditional organized crime, like the mafia sort of thing, or Hell's Angels, outlaw motorcycle gangs, or street gangs, doesn't really matter. They're all organized. So we need to find a way to fund those levels of investigations to combat those things. We need to find a more effective way of, you know, going into hotels and hopefully rescuing more young people that are the victims of human trafficking. And the public needs to know that when they go to those people for those services, prostitution is legal, but human trafficking is not. And you're just perpetuating things. It's just like child pornography wouldn't exist, but there's victims of it. So I think those things which go on across Halton, I mean, the QEW is right outside the window. There's hotels all along it and the 401 as well through Milton. And I would definitely want our citizens to know that these are issues that are here as well. And from time to time, that may require investments above and beyond the uniform officers you see out on your streets, because we need to play an active role in joint force investigations with Peel and Toronto and York and Durham and Hamilton and Waterloo and other police services. So everyone needs to put a little bit more skin in the game when it comes to combating some of that organized crime sort of thing, side of the crime business.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I'm curious around your views around how policing has changed, you know, looking over the course of your career, you know, thinking about some of the biggest changes. And you had mentioned something a bit earlier as well that also struck me. You had mentioned Bernardo and Carlo Hamoka, and I think, you know, they must be the most infamous case in Canadian history. And it's amazing just to think back that even when, I think it was earlier this year, that Paul Bernardo's parole hearing had come up, and it still strikes such a visceral reaction in so many Canadians. I'm curious, maybe first thinking about changes in policing, you know, what was that time like for you when that case and those awful crimes were happening? How did you experience that, and how did that start to change the trajectory?
Yeah, I think It sort of took policing and maybe Canada took away some of our, I'm trying to think of the word, naiveness, innocence, mm-hmm. That we like to think those sorts of things don't happen. I mean, there were some, just trying to think of the individual that was arrested around Tofino and Ucluelet on Vancouver Island. So there have been others. Robert Picton from the pig farm in BC, and there was a famous mass murderer from many, many years ago, like back in the 70s, I would think. So there have been others, but this was just recent and local and Ontario, you know, and since we've had Colonel Williams from CFB Trenton, which was close to where I was in Belleville, although he was not there at the same time. And then the horrendous shootings in Nova Scotia were different. But I think it sort of ripped the bandage off the innocence of what we might expect to deal with. Mm-hmm. And where even the coroner's office got into thinking everything was an issue until proven otherwise, right? So you had to think dirty when it came to a sudden death, as opposed to innocently that it was an accident or something else. And so that kind of changed some of the mindset around those things. And technology has been a huge change in policing and a cost to policing, but it's also been, in some ways, it's a blessing on the abilities we have when it comes to some crimes, which, you know, back if it was Bernardo again now, there might be different types of evidence of his behavior and his and her behaviors and actions that we may not have had back then. Mm-hmm. There's also other things that have developed that make it more complex, whether that's, you know, the deep dark web or encrypted everything and secure devices, and whether you're able to access devices even with judicial authorization, which we would always do. So it becomes complicated. And I think the checks and balances the justice system has put in place on what police need to access different bits of information under different circumstances, but they also have to allow for the powers to do those things when we do need to, because sometimes that's never built on what the majority of Canadians want. I think the majority of Canadians want a peaceful, law-abiding society and people to be held reasonably accountable, certainly not, you know, unlawful or unjustified search and seizure and all those sorts of things. But as long as we go through the steps of search warrants and judicial authorization and all the other things that we need to do now, those investigations can still come to a successful conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Some great reflections, Steve. Thank you. And so I guess taking some of those last thoughts you had, what do you see as some of the biggest issues or challenges facing policing, whether externally to the organization that members will have to deal with, or dealing with internally, like say a changing workforce or things like that? I'm curious around, you know, what are the next big changes for policing in your view?
Yeah, I mean, externally, there's high expectations on policing, but I always say to our new recruits when they start, usually at their graduation, people will expect a lot of you, but rightfully so, because you are being given a lot of power and authority, and you're given authority up to and including in the most extreme situation that you may have to take a life to protect yourself or someone else. And so you're really in a very serious business that which you have to find a way to make fun most of the time when you can. But you also have to be cognizant of the fact that the world's changing, expectations, social media, as we just mentioned, video cameras. I don't think in 1982, I can't imagine where I would have been on video when I was out patrolling the streets in Burlington in the last part of 1982. And now I say to our recruits, just assume you're on video 24 hours a day, or at least every hour that you're working. But actually, even when you're not, because someone may know who you are and see you doing something and videotape it, and it's still going to become an issue for you. So you've got to, you have to change. I think our new recruits are used to everyone. They all have the devices and they all have at least one phone with them 24 hours a day. It didn't used to be that way. So that's That's changing a lot. And I mean, the equipment will continue to change, but some of that has been very positive, including tasers, which are a very safe way in a very serious situation to apprehend someone without injuries to anybody. But as the technology changes and we all look at when we're going to have body-worn cameras, they're not as much of a pressing issue here in Halton as they are right now in Toronto and Peel, as an example, but they will be coming here. So then those are other pressures for policing, because it's how do you store all that information? How do you retrieve it when you need it, and what's it cost? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't cost me personally, it costs every taxpayer. So we have to make sure that we invest the most effectively and efficiently we can with every dollar that those taxpayers give us through the budget process. But I think, you know, the drugs continue to evolve. Years ago, we would never have seen, we thought heroin was probably one of the worst things, and then crack cocaine, and we don't see much crack cocaine anymore. And now it's fentanyl and meth and things that can be manufactured as opposed to sometimes imported. But cocaine is still a huge issue and a huge moneymaker for organized crime. So we're probably going to see if not the legalization, the decriminalization of simple possession of a lot of different drugs. And I'm not against that. I think really if someone has a small amount of whatever it is for personal use and they're addicted, those are addiction issues, health issues, mental health issues. So that really fits in well with the whole community safety and well-being approach to things, that it's bigger than the police. We're just one part of it, but we have to do the enforcement part when it comes to the organized crime side of the supply of those drugs. So it's very multifaceted in how we need to approach that. But it's, again, it's much bigger than the police, and it's going to require funding. And mental health is only increasing, mental health issues that we deal with, and the tragedy of suicides and attempt suicides and calls for help often, and the very resource intensive. And there's lots of calls for, you know, take that out from the police and give it to someone else. And I would say, quite frankly, that's very difficult to do. We can take calls with a mental health worker being on the line. That might help in a certain number of cases. We may have a situation that's not violent at the time of the call, and then it turns violent, or it already is violent, and that's the reason the police are called. So really, that's going to come down to money. And for the province or anyone to put a 24/7 service or organization across Ontario to respond to only mental health is going to be more expensive in some ways than having the police do it. So we have to invest in training, certainly, and our continuation of our mobile crisis rapid response teams with mental health workers. But it's all of those things are becoming more complicated for our officers on the road to navigate and always look at de-escalating things, because that's what we do, and treating everyone fairly.
It's such a key aspect of the defunding argument around just take money away from the police and give it to social services. But it isn't that simple or straightforward. And a lot of work has to go into that, including making sure that those agencies are indeed capable 24/7 and able to deal with that. And that doesn't also preclude the police needing to be involved as well in such fast-moving, unpredictable situations. I know we had mentioned, Steve, you mentioned a few different cases and experiences you've had, but I wanted to ask you, are there any memorable cases or experiences that have stayed with you? And I'm curious what they might be and why they've kind of stayed with you all this time.
Well, I think, Bernardo has, even though I had a less of a role in it, I got to know Debbie Mahaffey a little bit, Leslie's mom. And so there is that personal side to the worst of crimes, right? My old partner and I, many, many years ago, designed a soft interview room in the Burlington Police Station, which was dedicated to Leslie Mahaffey. And it was, you know, community fundraising and supported. And there was another young lady who was murdered in Burlington, Nina DeVilliers, by a fellow named Jonathan Yeo, who ended up taking his own life when he was being arrested by Hamilton police. But he had committed that murder and then gone to New Brunswick, I believe it was, and killed two other people and came back. And I got to know Priscilla DeVilliers, who went on to be a very high profile victims advocate, but at a very high cost to her and her family, obviously. And there's so many sexual assault victims who you've got to know in whatever way over the years through some of those investigations that you remember and wish that those things hadn't happened. But you have to do the best thing for them at the time. And And hopefully there's some closure for them as well. So there are certainly things that stay with you. Colonel Williams was actually committing his crimes close to where I lived, mm-hmm. north of Belleville at the time, although I was by that point the chief of Kingston, but mm-hmm. he was in my neighborhood doing what he was doing. And one of the young ladies that he kidnapped and murdered lived very close to where I did, within a mile or two. Mm-hmm. So those sorts of things, you know, it really could happen to anybody. And it's the victimless, the crimes where you have totally innocent victims, mm-hmm. and those are all some examples of those, are a fair bit different than the gang-related shootings that we deal with. Unfortunately, some of those people have put themselves into that lifestyle and put themselves at higher risk. It's still a serious situation and a murder, and other innocent people could be hurt. But I think we need to focus on all crimes, because if we can prevent them or arrest the people that and the justice system keeps them in jail, we can have a positive impact and maybe save the next victim.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing those experiences, Steve. And just thinking about the last question I wanted to ask you was around, if you reflect back on your career and everything you've learned to date, what would you tell yourself as a rookie officer, knowing what you know now? What advice would you give yourself?
Yeah, you know, I think, and I tell every new recruit that you have worked hard to get here, so enjoy it. Don't wish the time by. People always do that, right? It's, I just got hired. I wish I was third class, second class. I wish I was first class. I wish I was a detective. I wish I was a sergeant. You got to take the time to enjoy all those different levels, because for one reason, life's too short and you should just enjoy what you're doing. The other thing is, sooner or later, you're not having some of that enjoyable experience working on those teams, you know, with fantastic results. You're more in a political, bureaucratic, administrative position and have to live life vicariously through the people that still get to do it. So I think I would say to people, or to myself, I think was one way of looking at it, right? It's that the letter you write to yourself as 16 or something. You need to work hard, but it's all about relationships. And it's there's the power of relationships, whether it's with your coworkers or with the person you're dealing with as a victim or the person you're arresting, to treat them fairly. Anybody through the justice system in this profession, you will be seen as that person that other people want to work with. That will lead more to your success than going back and getting a PhD or, becoming book smart, but maybe not so intelligent on the people side. I think it's a balance of that relationships and the relationships that you need to leverage for whatever you want. And we have people who may not want anything as far as special assignments and promotions, who are like, you know, I've 30 years as a police officer working the streets of one of our towns or Toronto or wherever you are, and they love it, then don't do something else that you don't love so much. So it's, I think sometimes as police leaders, you have to realize that the things that may have motivated you might not be someone else's motivation. So find the little things that are important to them and try to make their life a little bit better as well. And not everyone's created equally or has the same desire to do this job or any other job. So it is probably, I'd also say to them too, it is probably one of, if not the best professions I could imagine. Sometimes you think, what would it have been like to practice law or medicine or been an airplane pilot or been a vet? And it's about not having regrets, right? Mm-hmm. So enjoy what you're doing. But this is a place where every day you can probably make a positive difference in someone's life that you deal with, mm-hmm. whether it's in the office or it's out on the street. So enjoy it and make the best of it.
Very wise words, Steve. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and thank you for being so open with your thoughts and ideas and experiences. It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. I will do it again anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please give us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thanks, and we'll be back again soon.